Orphaned as a teenager, blues singer Janova Magnus grew up fast, in and out of foster care and on the streets of Detroit. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.
When you held me, you know you held me so right now. I felt like nothing could hurt me in the middle of the night.
Janova Magnus is here today along with her band. We'll talk about her life and her music, her work as a spokesperson for National Foster Care Month, and the vulnerability of songwriting. We'll also get an in-studio performance featuring music from her latest album, Stronger For It.
Oh no. But I'll keep pretending.
Join our conversation after the news.
I'll just keep on pretending.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me in the studio today is renowned blues singer Janova Magnus. She has just released her 10th album called Stronger For It, and she and her band are touring. They'll be playing in Davenport at the Redstone Room tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. Janova, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity, for having us on. I really appreciate it.
And I wish that everyone could see this because you are here along with your entire band. Zach Zunis is here, lead guitar, background vocals, Gary Davenport on bass guitar, Jim Alfredson on the keyboards, Matt Tekiu on drums, and we're all crammed into this little talk studio.
You could put a lot of things on a biscuit if you work carefully and slowly, you can do that.
I guess. Is this the smallest place you've ever played?
I think we might be setting a record today. We might be. I'll have to double check, but I'm pretty sure.
Well, I appreciate all of you coming in and your patience in getting set up in this tiny space. And Janova, I know you grew up in Detroit. When you were really young, did you sing?
I did. I sang along with the radio. I sang along with the TV, all the commercials. I knew all the words to all the commercials. I was the little kid bordering on obnoxious that sang along with everything and never had a difficulty understanding Mick Jagger or James Brown. I was that kid and, you know, putting on shows for the cat and the dog. That was me.
What kind of music did your family listen to when you were young?
Mostly country music. My dad had a pretty wicked country music, like Hank Williams, Buck Owens, Patsy Cline kind of collection, Tex Ritter, real country music, what I think of as real country music. And then he had some blues records. He had some Bull Moose Jackson stuff, and he also had Nat King Cole, early Nat King Cole stuff. So he had a pretty decent collection, and he played them pretty loud. He liked that.
Did that really speak to you as a kid?
I couldn't stand country music when I was a kid, but I think it was just the, you know, in part a pushing off kind of a thing. But I just loved music, you know. I just loved it, even as a young child, and really wanted to play piano, but that wasn't really an option when I was a kid. So, you know, I just loved performance, although I didn't really understand that as a small child. You know, it's not like you really understand it. At least I didn't.
Your life changed dramatically when you were a teenager.
Right. I lost, I became an orphan at a pretty young age and ended up in the foster care system for 2 years and change, 12 placements in 2 years, which is not an uncommon story. Sadly, you know, I've certainly heard much worse in terms of the number of placements and the frequency. But it is...
So 12 different families, 12 different homes in
correct,
2 years.
In 2 years, right. And then became an emancipated minor. I got pregnant at 16 and became an emancipated minor when my daughter was born at 17, when I was 17. And I guess that's one way of putting it would be fast track, although it wasn't pretty. It wasn't pretty. But I got so lucky. I got so lucky, you know. I got connected with the right placement in foster care. And truly, as a direct result of that, it made it possible for me to become who I am and what I am today.
And as, to stay alive. I mean, you were terribly at risk.
Yeah. Oh, I was hugely at risk. And I was a deeply troubled young lady, deeply troubled child. And, you know, there's been a fair amount of publicity in the last 10, 12 years about that because I've gone public about certain parts of my history, the early part of my life, simply because it turns out that I've come to understand that by talking about my experiences and standing today as a witness, you know, there's a vast difference between where I started and where I am. What I started with and what I have become are almost polar opposites. And although it is true that the early part of my life, I sort of think of it as stanky fertilizer these days, but it really informs my craft. I draw on that as an artist and as a singer, but I got really lucky. I found the right placement. I found one person, a very unlikely candidate, who literally stood up for me when I couldn't stand for myself at that time, and that changed not just one thing. It changed everything for me.
Tell me about that person.
Her name was Carrie. And just lost her actually in 2011. She just passed at Thanksgiving of last year. And she was a divorced mother of five children who happened to have her name on a list at a local youth center in Minnesota. This was Minnesota, by the way, where the foster placements were. I was living in Minnesota by then. And her name was just a name, number seven, I believe, down on a list of people that was willing to take in underage girls for up to 72 hours to keep them off the street in need of in a dire emergency situation. And lo and behold, there I was again in another dire emergency scenario. I ended up at a youth center Sunday night, and they were about to close their doors. And I needed a place to stay. I was 16. I was just out of a week in an intensive care unit. And I was pregnant and had literally burned all the bridges were gone now for me. And I needed a place, and she was number seven on the list. And she said, yeah, go, you know, bring her over. And at the end of that 72 hours, she sat me down and said, you know, we need to talk, honey. And she said, you know, I've been talking to, and she had five children with a deadbeat ex-husband who refused to pay child support. So she was on AFTC and working on the side part-time, scrubbing toilets in people's houses to try to get enough money to make ends meet for her and her five children. And she said to me, you know, honey, I'm so moved by what has happened to you. What has happened to you is awful. And if you don't mind, you're not leaving. And I said, what? Because people didn't say that to me. Pretty much people said, get out. You're too difficult. You're too troubled. You're too damaged. You're going to hurt our kids. We're scared of you. Just go. And she said, if you don't mind, you're not leaving. And what has happened to you can stop right here, right now. And I love you already, and the kids love you. So we would love it if you would be in our family, and we'll figure it out. Whatever it is, we'll just figure it out. And I, at 16, I had never heard that. It was a complete game changer for me.
I want to keep talking about this in a moment, but you brought all this equipment and all these guys. So
all these great men.
Right. Let's get to some music. What are you going to do first?
Well, it's going to be a song that I wrote with my producer, so it's an original tune. It's in the long line of tradition of blues songs about murdering someone. Only the thought, not the action. And it's called There It Is.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Magnus, this is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Janava Magnus, renowned blues singer. She's just released her 10th album. It's called Stronger For It, and she and her band are touring. They'll be playing in Davenport tomorrow night at 8 o'clock in the Redstone Room, and they're playing for us this morning in a tiny talk studio at Iowa Public Radio. And Janava, before we listened to that song, we were talking about your experience with foster care. And you've spent the last 6 or so years being a spokesperson for National Foster Care Month. And when you gave me that thumbnail sketch of your first couple of years after you lost your parents, you'd been in 12 different placements.
Right.
That doesn't sound like a foster care success story.
I know. Let me clarify. It is a foster care typical story. And not an uncommon, sadly, not uncommon. Now, that was in the 70s. The system has changed for the better. Now, is it still broken? There are parts that are still very, very broken, which is part of my chore, my job, my honor, my responsibility as a spokesperson for National Foster Care Month, which you're right, is a little over 6 years now. It's a huge honor. Daunting responsibility. I take it very personal. I'm also an ambassador for Foster Care Alumni of America, but we'll talk about that in a minute. But the job is really to talk about my experiences to encourage and inspire more good people to step forward, because that's what we need. We need more good people that the idea of what I'm talking about, my experiences, does it yank on your heartstring? I call that a clue. We call that a clue. We may call it even a calling. Fostering isn't right for everyone, but it's right for a lot of people. And the good news is, Charity, that the numbers of youth in foster care is going down. Current stats are roughly around 243,000 only. Those statistics, no, I'm sorry, I transposed the number because it's too early for me. Ah, sorry, 423,000 youth in foster care, give or take, any day of the week right now. And those numbers are decreasing. They have decreased quite a bit in the last six years since I've been involved as a spokesperson. Fostering isn't right for everyone, but it's right for a lot of people. And it turns out that there are many things that people can do to help change the lifetime of a child at risk, just like someone did for me. Fact, if that youth center hadn't had that volunteer that was willing to stay an extra 15 minutes past the clock of closing, I would have never found Carrie, would I? You tell me. Let's talk about less than 6 degrees of separation. Let's talk about saving lives, literally, in my case, in seconds and inches. I don't want to sound overly dramatic, but it is dramatic. It's intense. It's real life. It's human life in a ballast. So we need more people to step forward.
When you describe Carrie, she doesn't sound like a woman who had anything left to give. I mean, with five kids and being a single mom and trying to take care of them, but she clearly did.
She clearly did, and she was a very kind, loving, very intelligent woman with boundaries. She was not afraid to love me, even though I was incapable at that time of loving myself. She was not afraid to love me, neither was her family. And wow, you know, what a game changer for me. It didn't stop in that moment at that time all of my struggles in life, but it planted seeds, literally, that took hold and really took deep root for me. I'm working actually on a book right now, and one of the chapters is called Carrie's Garden. Yeah.
She didn't just save one life that night. She saved two, because you were pregnant at the time.
Yes, in fact.
And you gave birth to a little girl.
Right.
You chose to give her up for adoption.
Right. It was clearly what needed to happen. I made that choice when she was 4 months old, and I was emancipated as a minor by then. I was on my own, and I wasn't going to make it. I wasn't making it. I came to the party with a lot of demons, and I was quite convinced that I was going to die very young. I was quite sure of it. My parents had both taken their own lives by the time, first my mom when I was 13 years old, and then my dad right after I turned 16. He killed himself 2 months after I turned 16. And, you know, they weren't bad people, but they were sick. They were really troubled people. And that was one of the things that I inherited from both of them, was that mental instability, that great darkness. And I was not free of that when she was born. And so I knew, there was no question to me, that I was going to have an early demise. And I could not live with the idea of leaving a baby girl like that. I couldn't. And so I knew what I had to do. Hardest thing I've ever done. Still, hardest thing I've ever done. But it was the right thing. Was it perfect? No. Is any life perfect? No. But it was right. And she was taken in. She was adopted by a family in Iowa, as it turned out. Yeah, farm town.
Being 17 years old and on your own and struggling like you were, to have the foresight to know what you needed to do to take care of your daughter. That seems like a remarkable thing to be able to do at that point.
I think I was not a typical 17-year-old, I'd had far too much life experience to be a child, even though I was still a child, but I wasn't. I was real conflicted. But I had what I now understand to be a moment of clarity. You know, we have them. And I don't think that moments of clarity are exclusively an adult experience. I certainly had one at that moment, and I knew very clearly. I saw my path very clear, and I knew it wouldn't be long. And I couldn't reconcile leaving a baby girl like that. I couldn't do it.
You were right about giving her up, but you were wrong about an early demise and that dark path. What happened? What helped you through this time? What did you hold on to pull you through?
Lots of things happened. And largely it was Carrie's garden that grew in spite of me. You know, I had a pretty long struggle on that path forward. Alcoholism, drug addiction, very active in both of those dark sides. Tried to take my own life several times. And I had tried to take my own life several times before she was born. Died a couple of times in both of those, in a couple of those efforts. I actually died. So there was still a lot of moving, still a lot of traveling, still changing addresses a lot, doing a lot of geographics, you know, and I would find myself in recovery eventually, which was a good thing, and I'm really grateful for that. I would find myself having the great fortune of finding some really good therapists. And I really needed some really good therapists.
When did you find the blues?
And the blues. I was about to get to that. And then there was the experience. You know, I loved music. We already talked about that. I was the little minor bird kid putting on the shows for the cat and the dog. But I had a riveting experience when I was 14, well before she was born. I got to see some tremendous live music. Otis Rush, for one, B.B. King the same year. But that experience that I had initially with Otis Rush was another game changer for me, because up until that point, I was really a disconnected young girl. My experience in the world had not been great thus far, and I was not uncommon for foster youth just sort of walking around in this disconnected state. I understand today that it has everything to do with post-traumatic stress disorder, which I have. But I didn't know what that was. We didn't have a diagnosis. We didn't have a label for it in those days. And that experience, that live performance that I got to see Otis Rush, was riveting. And it connected me in a way that I had not experienced until that point. I didn't really understand what happened to me. I began weeping. I couldn't stop. It was shocking. It was devastating. It was riveting. It was like he ripped my heart out of my chest and took it away from me, held me hostage. The music, the gift of that experience, held me hostage in every good way. And I didn't really get what happened that night either. It was over in a club called the Union Bar over in Northeast Minneapolis on like a Tuesday night in a December snowstorm, wicked bad snowstorm. And all I knew is that I needed to find more of that experience, because it made me feel like I was in the world with him and other people. And it was weird and foreign, but beautiful. And so I started to chase that experience. And I wouldn't be until many, many, many years later that I would take a risk and think, well, maybe you should try to do what you've always wanted to do, which is to sing anyway. That happened a long time, 5 years later.
And you worked your way into the business, not singing, but getting behind the window and doing sound engineering, right?
You have done your homework, young lady. Yes, ma'am, I did. At one point in 1978, and I had done a little bit of singing, but not a lot, but in 1978, I was 22 years old, and I knew that I wasn't going to be able to pursue the singing career one more time. I knew, beyond any doubt, that I wasn't going to be able to sing because I wasn't going to be able to hang on to any kind of recovery if I did, you know, because I'd have to be in bars, and that just wasn't anything I could keep myself from. I couldn't control myself. So I thought, well, in a typical, what turns out to now I understand is a classic Magnus moment, I went, well, screw it. I'm going to do the next best thing. I'm going to become a recording engineer. It doesn't matter to me that there's no women. I don't care about that. It doesn't matter to me that I have no money. I'll find a way. I'll figure it out. I'll get somebody to, you know, I'll do this thing. Because then I could be around music, and I could be around musicians who were people that I understood, and oddly, they understood me. It was weird. And so I found a way to get a grant, go to electronics school to become an engineer, got a internship at a recording studio. You know, I mean, all of that manifest, you know. It was wild.
And how did you start singing again?
And then I was working one night late. It was a late night session. I was an assistant engineer, so my job was to set the mics, set the cables, do all that stuff, scrub the toilets, get the coffee, get the food, do the doofo, right? And it was a late night session, and I was out front. My job was kind of done at that point. I had my head down on the reception desk, and I was half asleep, and the buzzer rang. Hey, we need some background vocals. And I said, well, okay, you want me to call somebody? And they're like, no. Didn't you used to sing? And I was like, well, yeah, you used to sing. We know you used to sing. Get in here. I said, we got to get somebody because I'm not, get in here. I don't want to, if you want to keep your job, get back here. Literally. That's what the engineer said to me. And I went, okay, I'll be right there.
Well, this seems like the perfect moment to listen to your voice then. Let's hear another tune. This is what, I Won't Cry.
Right. This is another original tune written by Dave Darling and I called I Won't Cry.
The harder the words, the colder the night, the closer the hand, the sharper the knife, the tighter I hold on, the further you seem to fly. I get cut, I might bleed, but I won't cry. Bigger the love, blacker the bruise, yeah. Less that you give me seem like the more I could use. The longer you hold out, harder I have to try. I get cut, I might bleed, but I won't cry. The quicker the lie, the softer the moan. All of those whispers, they just sink like a stone. I think maybe mama should just push on before those fists just fly. I get cut, I might be,
won't cry. Just stops. But once more, I just hold on till I get strength to fly. I get cut, I might bleed, but I won't cry. I get cut, I might bleed, but I won't cry. No, no, I get cut, I might bleed, but I won't cry.
Janova Magnus with I Won't Cry from her most recent album, Stronger For It. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nevy. My guest today is blues singer Janova Magnus. We've been listening to some tunes from her latest album, which is Stronger For It. It's her 10th album, and she and the band are touring right now. They'll be playing in Davenport tomorrow night at the Redstone Room at 8 o'clock. And we haven't been listening to a CD. We've got the whole band jammed here into the studio, sounding terrific today.
Yes. You love this.
Oh, this is a blast. This is a blast. And Janova, before the last song, we were talking about how you kind of got sucked back into the world of singing almost against your will, although I'll bet it felt good. Once you started singing again,
eventually, you know, I've had a funny relationship with that idea of feeling good. I'm pretty good with it these days, but at that point in my life, I was much more familiar and much more experienced with the darkness and with loss than I was with the universe saying yes to me in some kind of form, and so it was really terrifying. And I couldn't resist it. It was horrifying, and I couldn't resist it. It was, I really wanted to run. I would have huge anxiety attacks, literally, before singing, you know, but I couldn't not do it. Do you know what I mean? The desire, what it did for my spirit, how it lifted my heart would override all of that angst. Thank God. You know, really, how lucky is that? It's very lucky. And it turns out that you know, the experience of an alumni, in this case, that's the word we have for it now, the experience of foster youth and children that have aged out, and alumni as we are once we age out, is a tremendous connection with the arts. There's a huge benefit there for youth at risk with the arts. So, and I was no different. I was classic in that regard.
Both of the songs that we've heard so far today, and the next number you're going to do as well, these are all original songs.
Right.
You wrote these songs, and I've read that that was something that didn't come easily to you, not because you can't do it, clearly you can, but because it made you feel too vulnerable to write music?
It's a pretty scary proposition. And I was married almost 17 years to a very prolific songwriter. And so why would I go there? And I really have seen myself as more of an interpreter of other people's material, although I've been nudged, bugged, harassed for years to write my own songs. I've done a little bit of it, but not a lot. And So I had to get up off of that posture on this record. I was getting tremendous encouragement from my producer, Dave Darling, who I trust implicitly, and he's a dear friend, as well as a lot of support from Alligator Records, which is the label that I'm on now. They're the biggest blues label in the world with the biggest hammer, so to speak. And I lost the marriage last year, you know, and so I thought, well... And that was actually an interesting piece of dialogue between me and my former husband. He said, well, at one point, rather meekly, are you sure you don't need any songs? And I said, no. Thanks. And I thought, okay, now I'm right. So, you know, it's really, in my case, I got to say, Charity, it's a very good to be wrong. Again.
So much of the great music that we have comes out of breakups and hardship that.
Life on life's terms.
How does it feel different to be performing your own songs?
I take my work very personally. I always have. But this is a different level of vulnerability for me. And it's wildly fun for me to step out on the bandstand, introduce a song, and then watch the members of the audience either sing along or mouth the words. It's wild. Like they really have been listening. They know it. They know the song when they walk in. It's wild. It's wonderful. It's a huge compliment. It's about connection, which ultimately that's what the job is about. Took me a long time to come to understand that, but I finally understand what my job is. And the gift is the music, but the job is about human connection. So I have to be able to bring myself to the song and to the music and in the moments of actual performance. It's got to be real for me to be able to make the connection with people. And that's what people get. They get the feeling, whether people understand it or not, the feeling is I'm not alone. The feeling is I get it. The feeling is I understand. The feeling is I know that level of determination. You can cut me. I'm going to bleed. But you will not get the best of me. It ain't happening. You can't have it all. And people get that, you know. Or, you know, as in the case of... the first tune that we did, which is a feeling like, you know, I just could just clobber you permanently, you know. It's beautiful. It's wonderful for me.
Let's hear another original. What's this one?
This one is about a child's game, and I've been doing it my whole life. And I guess it's some of how I've gotten through and some of how people get through. This one's called Whistling in the Dark.
When you held me, you know you held me so right now. Felt like nothing could hurt me in the middle of the night. I suppose if I was telling the truth now, there'll be no way for me to get over you. Oh no. So I'll keep pretending. I'll just keep on pretending and whistling in the dark. When I was a baby child, I'd always run away and hide. You know it's true. Always thinking they could never know how much I cried.
Don't tell a soul.
Those days are longer, But some nights I still feel the same. I know you're leaving, and I think maybe I only got myself to blame. But I'll keep pretending,
I'll keep pretending,
I'll just keep on pretending,
I'll keep on pretending,
I'll just keep on pretending, and whistling in the dark. Well, I know I should have seen it, 'cause we were so high and we fell so slow. You tried to tell me, I just didn't want to know. I don't want to know, no. I'll keep pretending, I'll just keep on pretending, yeah. I'll just keep on pretending and whistling in the dark.
Whistling in the Dark, Janova Magnus and her band. That's from her latest album, Stronger For It. Zach Zunis on lead guitar, Gary Davenport on bass guitar, Jim Alfredson on piano and keyboards, and Matt Tecu on drums. And Janova, we were talking earlier about the very difficult times you had when you were 16 and 17 years old, and you gave your daughter up for adoption when you were 17 years old, and she reconnected with you.
The actual term is reunification, and what happened was that I reached out to her family because I realized at a certain point, apparently I was grown up enough. when she was 16, she was about 16 when I did this, I realized that I didn't know where she was. Was she dead or alive? I knew nothing. And that was more in that moment, at that time in my life, than I could bear. So I reached out to her family. I wanted to write a letter to explain what happened. And I also wanted her family to have medical family information, because I realized how important that was. I didn't want to upset anything. That was the last thing I wanted to do. You know, her parents, her mom and her dad, and that's how I see it, her mom and her dad, did the greatest human act for me that is possible. They took my baby and they raised her in a way that I was incapable of, in a stable environment. You know, she was raised in a small Iowa farm town, graduating high school, graduating class of 10. Okay. That was not what even would resemble what she would have seen had I kept her and not given her up. So reunification is the term. And what happened was I wrote a letter. I sent it to her family's lawyer. He found what he felt was the right moment to hand the letter over to her mom. And her mom read it and wrote me back and said, we are shocked at what happened to you. And we are grateful. And we know the world is a weary place, and that if there is love available for our daughter, we will not deny that to her. And so let's try this, but let's try it slowly. And so that begat a very slow communication process. It started with letters, and then that Christmas, that December, I came home, and there was a voicemail on my answering machine, and it was her. But it was me, but it was her, but it was me, but it was her. It was my voice. No, it wasn't my voice. It was her voice. And that begat phone calls and so on and so forth. It's a remarkable experience. I love her like no one else. We've been very, very close, and there is no one who can cut me deeper or quicker. And I guess that is family, right? It's an amazing relationship. It's challenging. It's hard. It's glorious. It's everything.
Her parents must be remarkable people. That seems like a moment that would be so frightening, to have your child's birth mother reach out and
right.
also to be this fabulous blues singer. I can imagine that would be even more frightening. Like, our daughter's going to think she's so amazing that how is that going to damage our relationship? They must be very strong, very secure people to be able to do that.
I think in that moment, her parents are both gone now. They've passed, unfortunately. But I think in that moment, her mother and her dad were having a big picture moment. I'm very grateful for that big picture moment. I feel like it was a spiritual thing. I feel like it was God, even though I don't really know what that is. I couldn't define that for you. You know, it's the spirit of the universe, whatever. I don't really know. I don't feel like it's my job to button that down. Good Lord, no. You know, I hope not, because otherwise the world's in trouble. But I feel like it was really a big picture moment for them. And I am eternally grateful to them for doing what they did. She has a sister who's also adopted. So there were two girls. You know, it's beautiful.
You've had a hard couple of years again.
Yeah.
What does the future look like to you now?
Oh, you know, I am, as you've been telling the listeners, I'm touring on the release of my 10th CD. That's a big deal to me to have 10 records out that say Geneva Magnus on them. I have the best touring band I've ever had in my life. I'm really grateful for these guys. They're a wonderful group of people. They're brilliant musicians. I want to tour. I'm on the premier blues label in the world, Alligator Records. It's like, you know, my life today is so far from where I started. I just want to keep touring, and I hope to write some more songs. I'd like to finish this book. You know, I think it's really fun and amazing to have people singing along with the songs that I've written or co-written. I want to do more touring. It's what I do. I love it. It's so much of my lifeblood to get out there and connect with people and to play music. It really gives me life.
Well,
it's wonderful.
We will be listening.
Thank you.
Geneva Magnus, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
The latest album is Stronger For It. They're touring right now, and they'll be playing in Davenport at the Redstone Room tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. And would you play us out?
We will. And I just want to say one real quick thing, if
sure.
I can. If people want to find out more about what they can actually do to help change a child's life, go to my website, GenevaMagnus.com, or go to FosterCareMonth.org and FosterCareAlumni.org. You alumni out there, there's over 12 million of us. Come on, we're brothers and sisters. Check it out.
All right, and
thanks,
you're going to play us out with Make It Rain, a Tom Waits song?
Oh, yes.
All right.
He took all my money, then my best friend. Now you know this story, here it comes again. I have no pride, I have no shame. You got to make it rain, make it rain.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Technical support today from Jim Davies. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, Lakeisha Johnson, iconic images of the revolutionary black woman. This is Talk of Iowa.